The Guardian.
Hi, Ian Sample here. Before you get started with this edition of Science Weekly, we want to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For everything you need to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian to get 10% off your first purchase. And now, on with the show.
I wanted to see him while he was laughing.
Matthew, say hi, Dad.
Take a moment to think about an early childhood memory. A walk in the park with a parent, feeding the ducks with a sibling, or a trip to the zoo. Now, what if I was to tell you that that memory you have never actually happened? Or at least not the way you think it did. This is the world of false memories, and as much as it might pain you, it is a world we all live in.
I think we've always sort of known that memory is creative and complex and flexible, and certainly legal processes generally do reflect this as well. I mean, you see five eyewitnesses, and they're all telling a different story. And so I think it's impossible to assume that they must all be lying, and it's more intuitive to assume and understand, well, they've just remembered them differently.
People need to realize that they probably have little bits of fiction sprinkled throughout their memories, and most of the time it doesn't matter very much. It doesn't matter if I tell you that I had a hamburger last night instead of chicken. But when it comes to these legal cases where someone's liberty is at stake, then precise memory does matter.
I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly.
Have a coughing fit or whatever. it always happens, so it's not...
To help me delve into this murky and uncertain territory, I sat down in the studio with London South Bank University criminologist, expert witness, and author of The Memory Illusion, Dr. Julia Shaw.
The occasional person comes with like thumb through with like post-its all the way through, and then I'm really impressed with those people.
Before we get to the falsities, I first wanted to know which parts of our brain are important for memory in general. Something I put to Julia.
The whole brain is involved in memory. So this is something that is sometimes misunderstood, because sometimes we talk about the hippocampus. So the hippocampus is a part of the brain that is important for memory, but it's specifically responsible for turning short-term memories, which are usually really short, so like 30 seconds, something that you've just experienced, into long-term memories, things that last longer and can maintain in the brain. So that's what the hippocampus's role is, and it's critical that it works, but that's not where they stay. So that's not where memories stay eventually. And so what memories actually are is a collection of neurons, and these neurons are a network that's spread across the brain. And so this network is flexible, and it's creative, and it's reconstructive and constructive. And so you see sort of this ever-changing shape within the brain that represents a memory.
Can you take us through a typical memory process? How information in an external event is laid down and stored in our brain?
So the first thing you need to do is pay attention to something in order to form a memory of it. So I like to say that attention is the glue between reality and your memory. But once that's happened, and once you've paid enough attention to something and it starts to become a memory, what that process is called stamping. So you're stamping a memory into the brain. And that involves a couple of things, but the two most important things that are happening essentially is that, one, your neurons, so the brain cells that are involved in that particular memory, are communicating with each other, and they form a stronger connection. And so that communication becomes more fluid and becomes quicker. The other thing that can happen is you can actually form physical new structures in the brain, especially over time, which can change the way that your brain is physically structured and change the communication once again. So ultimately what you have is you end up with a network of cells that are connected in a way that's meaningful for that particular memory. And that's also what we refer to in science as an engram.
But as was alluded to by Julia, these memory networks, or engrams, are flexible and reconstructive. So much so that we can often get the details of a memory completely wrong without even realizing it. Something Julia points out can be done via different mechanisms, including confabulation and source confusion.
So confabulation is making up details. So essentially it's a spontaneous thing that happens in the brain where you fill in the blanks quite often. So you, let's say you remember two things. Let's say you remember you went to Disneyland and you were there with your aunt. Now, you can't remember how you got there initially, but you assume you must have flown. So that's potentially confabulation. So next time you tell the story, you're saying, well, then we flew to Disneyland and then I went with my aunt. And so it's essentially, yeah, filling in the pieces spontaneously. It's not a lie. It's not intentional. But it's a way to make sense of a narrative, to make a coherent story. The other thing that you mentioned was
source confusion.
Source confusion. And source confusion is when we forget the source of our knowledge. Now, what that means is that you can remember something without remembering where it's from, in the sense that, let's say you remember a fact. Let's say you remember that nothing rhymes with orange. Now, where did you learn that? You might not be able to pinpoint it. You might alternatively, again, confabulate or assume, saying something like, well, I must have learned this in school, and my favorite teacher was, and so suddenly, you know, Mr. So-and-so is the source of nothing rhymes with orange. So what you've done is you've confused where a source is from. Now, this we can also do for other things like experiences. So confusing something we just imagined with something that we actually experienced. Again, assuming that, well, the source was a real experience as opposed to just our brain picturing things as they could have been.
Can this have an impact on our identities?
Absolutely. So I'd like to think that memory is a foundation of our identity. And in many ways, when people read my book, they often come back and say, well, you know, who am I? What am I? And I think it's a good thing. I think that having an existential crisis is healthy. And what it really does is it makes us realize that there's a lot of fiction already in our memories, if you understand the science of memory. But our identity still rests upon it. So sort of everything you've experienced up to now makes you the person you are. And it also informs who you think you can be and who you think you want to be. So you think you had a great childhood. Maybe that's going to influence how you're going to behave as a parent. Now, whether or not that's based on reality, in the sense that things that actually happened, almost doesn't matter, because what matters is your memory of the event.
And weirdly, just the act of retrieving memories can make them more fictitious.
Retrieval is an interesting process in that, on the one hand, it feels like we are accessing something that sort of was somewhat permanently put down, and it's being brought back the way it was originally experienced, which science says is fundamentally wrong. But it's also fascinating that every time we recall a memory, we actually change its shape. So we add details, we omit details, we forget stuff. Someone tells a story about something we experienced with them, maybe in a social setting. We steal some of their details. We're what's called a memory thief. And maybe they steal some of ours. So there's social influences, there's neurological influences, and there are other kinds of influences that change the shape every time we retrieve it. On top of that, there's something called retrieval-induced forgetting, which means that, again, every time you activate an engram, a memory representation in the brain, you lose pieces, and again, you reform essentially that memory. So you're literally picking up something, completely rewriting it, and sticking it back in, which is something that is totally counterintuitive, I feel, because it feels like, sure, maybe poking around, moving things around a bit is one thing, but it looks like we actually potentially completely rewrite a memory every time we recall it.
And whilst much of this is now widely accepted within the psychological and scientific community, the same could not be said if we travel back almost four decades when a pioneering cognitive psychologist was entering the field.
Hi, how you doing?
This is Elizabeth Loftus.
My title at the University of California, Irvine, is Distinguished Professor, but you could just call me Professor, I guess. So.
Producer Max spoke to Elizabeth on the phone this week, and he started by asking her when she first realized that our memories might not be as reliable as once thought.
After I started teaching, I started to do studies of eyewitness testimony, and some of my early experiments showed that even asking somebody a single leading question about a simulated crime or accident that we had exposed them to was enough to distort their memory for the details of what they saw. And ultimately, I began to see these leading questions as just one source of post-event information that people are sometimes exposed to that can contaminate or distort or transform their memory.
Something Elizabeth was able to show time and again with experimental evidence.
In, in one series of studies, we showed people a simulated auto accident where a car went through an intersection with a stop sign, and we convinced people that what they had seen was a yield sign controlling the intersection rather than a stop sign. We distorted people's memories for the details of the appearance of individual people, so we could make witnesses who actually saw a guy with straight hair remember it as curly hair. We could do all kinds of things to change people's memories for the details of events they had actually experienced.
And this included landmark studies on the role that suggestive language can play in the creation of false memories.
Some of those early experiments contaminated memory by asking leading questions. So you ask a witness who's seen an accident a question like, how fast were the cars going when they smashed into each other? And we found that they estimated the speed of the cars as going faster than if you questioned them with a verb that was more neutral, like how fast were the cars going when they hit each other. And that was also one of our early findings. The particular word that you chose to kind of ask about the event could affect what people recall.
While much of her work on the so-called misinformation effect was based in the lab, it became obvious to Loftus that the findings could be very relevant in a court of law.
I happened to know one of the chief attorneys in the public defender's office in the state where I was teaching, and so I volunteered my services for free to help on a particular case in exchange for being able to experience things and see things close up for myself. And that was my first effort to work on an actual case. It was a murder case. The defendant happened to be a woman. She had shot her and killed her boyfriend. There was an issue about whether it was self-defense or whether it was premeditated. And it involved eyewitness testimony. And I worked on that case with the lawyer, wrote about the case after the case was finished, and that really was the beginning of my particular involvement with court cases and with the application of psychological science to legal cases.
And as we'll hear after this short break, it was an involvement that continued in the decades that followed, becoming even more pressing when Loftus's lab and others took the idea of false memories to a whole new level.
Maybe these kinds of memories that people are thinking they're experiencing are creations that are a result of suggestion that led to the planting of an entire false memory.
We'll be right back.
Hi, Nicola Davis here. This episode of Science Weekly is sponsored by Squarespace. To find out more about how to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
Hi, Susanna Tresillian here, producer of the Guardian Books podcast. If you're enjoying this edition of Science Weekly, make sure to check out last week's episode of the Books podcast, featuring neuroscientist and memory expert Professor John Aggleton and author Colin Thubron.
Can it be said that, and rather ironic, that the memories we keep going back to and the ones that might be most precious to us are therefore the most corrupt?
Head over to theguardian.com/podcasts to find out more about the episode, or download the Books podcast on your favourite podcast app.
We spend around a third of our lifetimes asleep. And when you think about it like that, isn't it time you change your mattress to something a little more, well, scientific? That's why we've teamed up with Casper. Casper's in-house team of engineers spent thousands of hours obsessing over the entire sleep experience. They've employed cutting-edge NASA technology to come up with the most comfortable mattress on the planet, and Time magazine named it one of the best inventions of 2015. The Casper combines springy latex and supportive memory foams for a sleep surface that's got just the right sink and just the right bounce, and its breathable design helps you regulate your temperature throughout the night. Casper mattresses are also shockingly affordable. There's no delivery charge and you can try it for 100 nights in your own home completely risk-free. If you don't love your new mattress, Casper will pick it up and refund you for everything. Because you listen to the Science Weekly podcast, Casper want to give you £50 towards your new mattress. Just head to casper.com/theguardian and enter the offer code theguardian at checkout. That's casper.com/theguardian.
Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Ian Sample. And before the break, we heard that our memories are not as infallible as we like to think. They can be changed by language, by context, and even by the very act of recall. What happened next in the field stunned even some of its biggest names, but not Elizabeth Loftus.
I was asked to work on another murder case where a woman was claiming that she had seen her father kill her best friend when she was 8 years old, her little best friend, and that she repressed her memory for 20 years, and then her memory came back to her. And in working on this case, this murder case, this really opened my eyes to the idea that these claims of repression actually did not have credible scientific support for that sort of process, and that maybe these kinds of memories that people are thinking they're experiencing are creations that are a result of suggestion that led to the planting of an entire false memory.
Something Julia Shaw calls memory hacking.
Within memory science, there we've been doing memory hacking, if you will, for about 40 years. And we've been convincing people of little things, like thinking they saw a stop sign when they saw a yield sign, or big things, like entire events that never happened, like having tea with Prince Charles, having a hot air balloon ride that never was, or even committing a crime that never happened. And that's where my research fits in, is that I build on decades of research that have shown that memory is reliably fallible. So if you use certain social influences and you get people to essentially imagine things as they could have been, you can change their realization, their notion of reality. So you can implant entire experiences that never happened, such as committing a theft, assaulting someone, or assaulting someone with a weapon with police contact. And so all you need really is trustworthiness. So you need people to believe that you know something about them that they don't. So you suggest an event, but you need to come from a place of authority. So you need to, in most of these studies, we contact the participants' parents ahead of time, who are now university students. So the participants are university students, and we contact their parents. And the parents give us information about one true event, and they give us the name of their best friend at the time of the age that we're trying to implant. So in my case, it's between 11 and 14. And the place they lived at the time, and they need to confirm that they've never actually experienced the event we want to implant. And from that, we just take it from there, and we get people to repeatedly picture the event happening. And what you find is that between 20 and 70%, depending on the study you're looking at, of people agree and go, yeah, that happened to me, and here's how it happened and why.
Isn't that quite terrifying?
It's not terrifying, but it's eye-opening. I think that for the criminal justice system, the repercussions of this kind of research are absolutely enormous. And people like Elizabeth Loftus have long been advocating for the use of our research in the courtroom and in police proceedings. And I think that when you see that in benign, benevolent research situations, we can, through basic social manipulation, like leading questions, like suggesting information, misinformation, so information that's inaccurate, or by just putting on subtle pressure, you can get people to say a lot of things that are untrue and even to believe them to be the reality. So for false confessions, this has tremendous weight, and as it does for eyewitness testimony or victim statements.
This weight was seen in full force during the 1980s in America with what was coined the Satanic Panic. Elizabeth Loftus again.
After I was involved in that murder case where the daughter claimed that she had witnessed her father kill her best friend, that she had witnessed other murders, that she had experienced extensive brutalization, sexual abuse, and other kinds of abuse by her father and others, allegedly repressed into the unconscious. After I began to work on that case, we began to see lots of other cases come forward where people were claiming that years and years and years and years ago they were sexually abused or they were brutalized in some extensive way by their parents or their former neighbors or other relatives or former teachers or doctors or dentists. And we began to see in North America people being sued based on these accusations. And so it was an epidemic. There were just thousands of these cases and thousands of sadly affected families. In the case of satanic ritual abuse, no credible corroboration.
Tonight, the subject under review is ritual child abuse, in which the practices described may upset some viewers.
Many were horrified by these numerous cases describing ritual and often satanic child abuse, and a witch hunt ensued. But Loftus used her knowledge of false memories to provide an alternative explanation. She and others argued that the claims may have been caused through suggestion by psychotherapists who were often driven by the Freudian remnant of suppressed memory.
For the first time, foster parents and social workers tell their story, and the children have a voice at last.
There were lots of different techniques that were being used in the psychotherapy. Some psychotherapists were using hypnosis to try to recover allegedly repressed trauma memories. Others were using guided imagination, sexualized dream interpretation, sometimes giving people material to read that essentially gave them false information. In my opinion, it was false information that helped to lead these patients to construct the false memories that they would then go on to act on.
What followed was a huge backlash against Elizabeth, with threats, lawsuits, and calls for her sacking. Despite this, she persevered and has since testified in over 250 cases, often as an expert witness.
So as an expert witness, I'm often asked to look at whether or not something might be a false memory.
A position Julia Shaw knows all too well.
And that is, on the surface, a reasonable question to ask. But in reality, that's not a question anyone can answer. So the only person who knows whether or not it's a memory or a lie is the person who's telling it. The only person who knows whether it's a lie, a memory, or a false memory is no one, ultimately. By looking at a memory, you can't tell the difference between a false memory, a true memory, and a lie. We're really bad at deception detection anyways. And because a false memory becomes that person's reality, they're telling it as if it's the truth. So what I do as an expert witness in the UK is that I look at the process through which a memory was retrieved. So if a witness or a victim or even a suspect has been questioned inappropriately, I flag that. If there's suggesting or leading questions, I flag those and I say this is problematic. If maybe a memory arose in hypnotherapy or therapy that's known to potentially have repercussions like false memories, then I flag that. So what I can do is I can look at the process and say, look, there's some significant problems here and these are problems that are known to create false memories. But ultimately, you can't just look at an account and say this did or didn't happen.
What kind of problems regularly crop up with eyewitness statements, victim testimonies, things like that?
So the biggest things that I see are problematic interview techniques. And I don't just mean that from the police officers, because ultimately, unfortunately, I don't always have the full transcripts of what's happened. So often, especially with witnesses and victims, all you see is the end product, which is useless to me because I can't see the process. I can't see whether or not the police officer has done a good job with regards to obtaining that account. And so that really indicates that there are problems within the criminal justice system with regards to safeguarding against false memories because we're not documenting as much as we should be in a way that we can later look at it and say, look, things went wrong here or they didn't. Right now, we often just don't know. So what I see regularly happening, though, is that there's evidence that police maybe suggest things to witnesses that they maybe didn't themselves say. So, you know, they'll make it clear that they think that this is their perpetrator or that they're suspect. And, you know, maybe you should pick this guy out of the lineup. In the UK, that's not allowed. But that doesn't mean that it's not a social situation where the person who's picking someone out of a lineup or potentially who's answering questions isn't picking up on what the police officer maybe wants to hear. Another thing that we often see is that victim statements, especially in false memory cases, become bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And they end up remembering an extent of details that arguably is impossible. So they have these incredibly vivid and incredibly elaborate accounts of something that happened over, let's say, 30 seconds. And they can talk for hours about it, which there's no way that you're recording all that information, never mind setting it into long-term memory. So there's issues with regards to how people think they can remember and how those memories are elicited by lawyers and police officers.
And whilst Julia did say that police officers and lawyers have a rough idea about the mechanisms of memory, this knowledge isn't always put into practice. Which is where people like Julia and Elizabeth come in. Looking to the future, something I wanted to know was how technology might be affecting our memories. With brains that have taken millions of years to evolve, are these newly created platforms and devices altering the way we remember?
Certainly, social media changes the way that we remember. So by being able to take a picture or tweet something right away, what you're doing is you're creating an external piece of information that's stored outside of your brain. So you're sort of outsourcing part of your memory. You're going, you keep this computer, or you keep this Twitterverse, which is useful because you have independent evidence that's not prone to the same memory distortion as things in your brain. But, and this is the big but, is that you can also be influenced, of course, by other people and by your own filtering. So let's start with other people. Let's say you witness a crime. Let's say it's a big crime. Let's say it's a shooting on the street and there are lots of witnesses. Now, in situations like that, we often see people live tweeting. And so they'll be tweeting about the event as it's happening. Now, if you go on Twitter and you see what other people are tweeting, you might start picking up those details, right? So you might start going, oh yeah, and next time you tell the story about the event, or the first time even you tell the story about the event, you've incorporated strangers' details who you would never otherwise have come in contact with from Twitter into your accounts. You've essentially constructed a false memory with pieces that you've picked up on social media. So that's one part. The other part is that you can hijack your own memories because we all filter what we post on social media. So social media generally is our best side. It's our best thoughts and our best pictures. And what that results in is that you're reinforcing those particular things you're tweeting, which you might be tweeting because you think that they're going to get a lot of likes or a lot of upvotes or a lot of whatevers. And so you're allowing sort of the social process of memory to be strengthened. So you're even more vulnerable to what other people have to say about your memories. And they're then subsequently going to reinforce those memories by talking about them more often. So you're pruning, you're getting rid of a lot more memories that aren't shareable. And on the other hand, you're reinforcing memories that are shareable that you end up sharing on social media that might not actually be that important to you either. So both for crime and for your identity, social media is dramatically changing the way that we remember.
So, our memories are clearly fallible, but that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Memory works the way it does for a reason, I like to think. And just like everything else in the body, it's generally good enough, for one, so it helps us to survive in some way, or at least it's not disadvantageous. And more importantly, I think that without the flexibility of memory, which is what causes false memories, we wouldn't be able to learn, we wouldn't be creative, we wouldn't be able to problem solve. Essentially, it makes us human to be able to creatively recombine pieces in the brain, memories, in ways that solve problems now, that, you know, help us survive.
If you want to find out more about the topics covered in this episode, make sure to get yourself a copy of Julia's book, The Memory Illusion, which can be found at all good bookshops, including The Guardian's Own. Special thanks this week to Julia Shaw and Elizabeth Loftus. I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly.